Hey everyone, I have my really good friend here, Dr. Hemant Qureshi, and let me tell you, we became friends a few years ago. He started his practice shortly after I started mine, and so we kind of grew up together, if you will, and learned a lot of lessons. And you know, Dr. Qureshi and I have talked through so many different things in private practice and growth and stages. So it became a very synergistic friendship. But at the same time, I wish that everyone knew what we went through, you know, and I feel like a lot of practices don't, but I think that's why we are kind of where we are today. So, but Dr. Qureshi, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah. So let's talk about your origin story, if you will, right? But you started at University of Texas Medical Branch, more in the academic setting and primary care, right? So can you kind of walk us through how did you go from there to where you are today? Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. So Chang, of course, first of all, thank you for this opportunity. I'm excited to be here and kind of just share my two cents and my experience with everybody. So yeah, I started at UTMB. I actually did residency at UTMB in family medicine. And then after residency, just stayed on as faculty. And so I was an assistant professor there for a period of about 4 years, where my principal role was basically taking care of their inpatient side of medicine. So I was the medical director for the hospital service. So we used to admit the patients that saw family medicine clinics in the outpatient, and admitted them and ran the inpatient service and did a side of, resident preceptorship in the outpatient setting. So that was what my primary role was. And I did that for about three and a half years, but continuing to, during that time period, always felt that, you know, would love for someday to work for myself. And there were certain things in the academic world. And don't get me wrong. I loved academics. I loved teaching. I continue to teach. I continue to have medical students, PA students, NP students that come and rotate with me till this day. So that is a big piece of that part I really did enjoy. But I felt like there was a ceiling, there was a limitation to some of the things that you could do, some of the things that you could not do, the bureaucracy of working for a big hospital system organization. And those were the things that planted that seed in my brain that, hey, you know, someday I would want to kind of break away from this and just not be bound to anybody and basically work for myself. So so that was the feeling. And it took a few years, but it finally came into fruition August 1st, 2018.
Oh, that's great. And this is why I want people to understand that, you know, the things that you value, which is teaching, you didn't give it up. You still had it in private practice, right?
Absolutely. No, I loved that aspect of academics. I love teaching. I love preparing for a lecture, giving back to students. And this is something that I continue to do till this day. When I have students and we have a topic like thyroid or diabetes management, and to teach them what I learned, what I know, so that, you know, that's one way of giving back, that I feel like it's important in our profession. And enjoy that immensely and continue to do that to this day, and hopefully would be able to continue doing that in the future.
Yeah, so me too, actually. So we have students that rotate through, and I'm clinical faculty as well, University of Texas at Arlington. Yeah. So, there's gotta be something that hit around the 3.5 year mark for you. To make you want to take that risk, because it's not an easy step, because there's a lot of uncertainties there. Do you think was that trigger that was there?
Yeah, I think that a couple of things. You know, one thing was that I was an assistant professor, and I had been doing the same thing for about 2.5-3 years. I was the medical director of the inpatient service. That was the height of my growth at that department. I mean, I didn't, unless I wanted to turn into, you know, becoming an associate program director and program director of the residency program, there wasn't a whole lot more growth for me to do. So that got me thinking that, you know, I'm young. I was in my mid-30s. I had an easier lifestyle, and that was time to work hard. And so that I kept that really, that thinking was always burning at the back of my mind that I should be working harder for myself. And enough time lapsed when I think a year before I opened, I said, you know what, I think this is enough time. And that's when I really started to plan ahead and look, you know, trying to formulate a plan to give myself about a year before I actually took the plunge.
All right. So academia allowed you to accelerate to a point, but then after a while, you're like, well, this may not serve me anymore because of the person I am right now. And therefore I changed, and it's okay to change your mind, people. You know,
it absolutely is. That's a very good point that you bring up, is that, you know, you become comfortable in a role initially and it's fantastic. And then you grow, you mature, you learn different things. And then a decision that was good maybe 2-3 years ago might not be the best decision anymore. And that's, like you said, that's okay. And it's okay to evolve as you evolve.
Absolutely. And you know, let's break it down into psychology for a little bit, because I think this is really important for people to know. If we look at the six human needs, and this is talked about by Tony Robbins, it's actually adapted from a psychologist, Maslow's hierarchy, which is a pyramid way of understanding what your basic needs are, your psychological needs are, emotional needs are, and stuff like that. But I think Tony Robbins has a very much clear-cut way of describing this. So the six human needs are the following. You have certainty, variety, significance, love or connection, growth, and contribution. Yeah. So I think what's going through residency at UTMB, you felt that you had room to grow at UTMB, right? Mm-hmm. University of Texas Medical Branch. And once you hit the apex of your growth, that growth is now crossed out, no longer serves you, right?
Yep, absolutely.
But yeah, so you hit significance. Once again, you cross it out because I feel significant because I'm program director and all the stuff like that. So that's done. So that's crossed out.
Yeah.
And then now you have contribution, which is basically contributing back to the medical students. And you're like, hey, I don't have to stop that in my own private practice. Absolutely. And I think where most people get burnt out where they are is that they feel guilty for already satisfying their original needs, but subconsciously they have different needs at the time with more growth and more contribution development that they feel guilty saying, I have to leave this nice, comfortable system mm-hmm. until, you know, there's some triggers to do it. So from a psychological perspective, and you did something that I did as well, is that, hey, this no longer serves me. And I feel like there's another calling and this is what I want to do in my practice. Now, if you're the type of doctor that say, hey, I can stay at UPMB for at least 15 years and continue to feel more sense of growth and significance, that's great. But for you in particular, you weren't one of those people. And when you were able to recognize it, you did something about it. And that's what's truly great about the decision, right?
Absolutely. I think that you summarized it so well. I think that taking that decision was not an easy decision because it was a comfortable role that I had evolved into and I was comfortable with. I was happy there. We had just a young family. It was a stable job. It was not necessarily a very difficult job. So taking that plunge, so to speak, was difficult. And like I said, there are some of my peers, colleagues, professors, mentors at UTMB who are extremely smart, way smarter than I am, who excel at continued growth into becoming a better teacher, becoming a better mentor, becoming, you know, in that academia path, which is amazing for them. It was just, I did not see myself following in right into that trajectory, which is why I think at that time, that break was necessary. I think my time at UTMB was very, very valuable in my growth as both a physician, as a person, as just a community member. And I think that experience put me in good stead to tackle many challenges that I later faced.
Yeah, and I think it's really important too, because you left a structure where you had a lot of mentors, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you go into a structure where you have none.
Yeah.
And it could be very challenging. And not only did you have none, there's other people in your shoes, but we don't know who's doing the right things in clinical practice and where you want to go. So it can become very lonely and cold, which I think for both of us, it was at the very
Yeah.
beginning, you know? And so how
Absolutely.
do you overcome that sort of mental barrier of taking that step to do the things? And how do you find mentors? What did you do?
So that's a great question, and I think that this is one of the most important questions of this conversation is to where to start, right? Where to look for. I don't have a very good answer that how do you find mentors? I just felt like I was just blessed and lucky that I had people, some people around me that had been doing this, and so I'll mention a few names. I've come from a family that has a lot of extended family as physicians, and a lot of them in private practice. So some of them had been pushing me that, hey, you need to open your own shop, you need to be working your own for yourself, you need to do private practice. So I had them kind of putting that in my ear for a few years. And then I'm going to mention this other very good friend of mine who's a dear friend. She's a mentor, she's a friend. Her name is Dr. Hussein. She opened her practice a couple of like a year and a half before I did. She was also a faculty member at UTMB, and seeing her do it about a year and a half before I did it kind of gave me a lot of confidence. I used to go and shadow with her, just go and sit in her office, when I had some time off from work, and just kind of learn how the business side of things ran. And so that is what is very important for people to realize, is to identify people, and there are people all around who you just have to look, right? Who reach out to people there, and you'd be surprised that most of the times people are willing to help other people. I would want to help any other person that I come across who's in private practice, who I can tell something to that might benefit them, for them to survive, to thrive, because I think that we're up against big hospital systems, and like people keep on reminding us we're a dying breed or whatever the case may be, which I don't typically believe in. But find a mentor, reach out, which I think that this forum is a great place for people who would want to, reach out and see other people who are doing it, and learn from their experience.
Oh, absolutely. But now that you've are in practice for a couple of years, I'm sure we're gonna talk about some lessons learned. But let's go into practice startup for a second. So the first question in practice startup that anyone has always for me, startup costs, finances, businesses. How do you allocate that, and what should you really be expecting?
So I'm going to tell you purely from my experience, because my experience was a little bit different than for example, my mentor's experience. So she took out a loan, made a business plan, met with a banker that, hey, this is how much the cost, took out a loan, rented a place, and started the build out. So that's one way of doing it. I went a little bit of a different route, in which I went through the route of an income guarantee. So what I did was that I got in touch with all the major hospital players in this area where I wanted to come and move to. And I said, hey, I'm a new PCP. I want to come and serve here. I want an income guarantee for a year. I went to Methodist. I went to Memorial Hermann. I went to HCA. And HCA was kind enough to give me that opportunity. And that's how I started. So how that works is, for people who don't know about income guarantees, is that you sign a contract with a big hospital system that you are going to essentially serve the area for about 3 years, and then your loan gets repaid one per month when you serve that area. So since I did not intend on moving, this was make it or break it for me. So I signed that contract, and knock on wood, it has worked out well. And they give you money for a startup. I think I got about $50,000 for startup money, which gave me an opportunity to, buy computers and tables and what have you.
Yeah, and I want to stress to people, an income guarantee is not necessarily a loan too, because there's government incentives for for underserved areas. And you'd be surprised what are actually underserved areas. Even in Houston, there's major, really crowded places that are actually underserved areas. There's government incentives to hospitals to allocate funding to attract point of entry practitioners as well as other specialists to the area. So they can either give you a loan or a hybrid, which is a loan with a loan for forgiveness. So if you stay in the zip code for 3 years, and then that loan they give you is essentially forgiven. For example, I had, you know, 150 grand, by the way, and that whole thing was forgiven. So when I did the startup, that's all it really took for me, right? So it wasn't a huge deal. This is my first practice. And there's also bonus incentives from different county systems as well. So if you're starting in private practice before you rent a place, before you sign a contract with any lease, because if you do, you no longer qualify for these. Before you do any of that, you talk to the hospitals first. Hey, what is going on? Do you guys have an ACO accreditation, and do you have funds that are dedicated to doctors? And all of a sudden, you're finding yourself having some cash flow there that you didn't really have to work too hard for, because there's really government incentives that the hospitals sometimes match one to one on to get people within the zip code to help funnel them into the hospital system. So that becomes a really, really powerful tool for a practice startup. Yeah. And then the other thing is, man, we both of us are lucky, because, you know, we ended up in zip codes that were allowed to do this. And it's not like we're in a rural area. We're not. Neither of us are. We're in a very heavily populated area in the greater Houston areas. And so it's really surprising what you'll find, as long as you'll talk to the hospital systems. Like I said, you talk to three major hospital systems, right? And say, hey, ACA has this great funding. Then it basically, it's a system of de-risking. You want to lower or eliminate any financial risk at the very beginning. And that's the way to go, man. I want to say kudos to you on that one.
100%. And I think one small important point to add to that is that a lot of times, I think that rule that you talk about is absolutely true. It's a government rule, and it has to go by a radius. So you have to come from a radius of more than 25 miles, if I'm not mistaken, inside the 25 or 30 miles outside the service area. So for example, this is what people who are listening who might want to explore this. If you are, for example, in Cyprus and you want to start a practice in League City, so that it's very much possible for you to go, but you have to keep in mind that you want to be moving to an area which is 25 miles out of your current practice area. For new physicians who are coming out of training or for coming out of residency, that really doesn't matter much, because I think that they are considered new, regardless of where they come from.
Yeah.
But for people who are already in practice or thinking of moving or starting out on their own, just keep that in mind, that it has to be an area of about 25 miles out of your of where you're trying to get an income guarantee from, so that that kind of plays a role into your decision making.
Yes, that's very true. So that qualifies for a lot of the government incentives, but make sure that you guys know that it's not from your home address; it's from the address that you currently practice at, or if you're a new physician, it's not going to matter. So if you want to practice close to home and you've never been within 25 miles of your home, then you're kind of in luck there, and just reach out to the hospital system and see. You're absolutely right. That's one critical move. But if you are moving from one place to another, believe it or not, hospitals like to compete with each other. So if you are within the one hospital system, you say, hey, I'm going to jump to this hospital system. The hospital doesn't even care about the government incentives. They just want you in their network. And so if you want to hop over to the network, then they also offer you incentives to be in their network. It's not as a big of a financial gain on that, but it's still a sizable amount. And all it takes is a phone call. And each hospital has a department called physician relations or physician accommodations. Yeah. And so and if you just call the hospital, call the operator, do you have a physician relations department specifically on new physicians wanting to the area? They always have someone there, because they have recruiters as well. You got to take advantage of that, because – the last thing you want to do is move into an area, get everything set up, and you realize, oh my gosh, you got to have $150,000 forgiven by the hospital system with an income guarantee, which kind of blows my mind that some people do and not have an idea that actually exists, you know?
100%. And you know, Chang, one of the challenges is that we get such a negative feedback when you're in second year, third year of residency, or even in practice, that, hey, this is something that cannot be done, right? It is, nobody does private practice anymore. Oh, you're good. You're thinking about doing solo practice. That's an unheard of concept. Like, it doesn't happen anymore. So I think that a lot of people get drawn out or get scared away or get pushed away by this narrative that, you know, it's something that is impossible to do. It has, obviously, it has its challenges, like any other thing in life has its challenges. But I think it's important to know what all the avenues that are available to us as physicians that we can explore, because hospitals will want to compete, and hospitals and contrary to what we think, primary care physicians hold a lot of power at the community level to kind of direct the flow of care. So hospitals are obviously interested in having a good relationship with you.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But let's dive in a little more about startup costs, because as you and I both know, when we first started the practice, we had estimations of what things would cost, and they may not fit that picture. And not only that, learning the revenue cycle, that's a whole other beast, learning about billing, collections, reimbursements, human resources, and all the stuff like that, right? Yep. And so it's like drinking from a fire hose. You just kind of get spray with it and see what sticks. And I encourage people to kind of fail forward. I mean, like, be in a hurry to fail and fail forward, meaning you learn from it, and you pick yourself up, which both of us have done in the last few years, you know? So, but sticking along the private practice and startup. So, okay, so you got the hospital to give you some money with an income guarantee, and you allocated some of that money. What was your sort of like first, second, third steps in doing this? Did you find people to hire first? What did you get the location first? Like, what did you actually do?
So actually, I kind of lucked out that HCA in the Tomball area was actually in the process of getting rid of a lot of their primary care employed offices. So I forget the name. This office that I'm at, it was actually an employed PCP office that HCA owned. Wow. Which was not HCA, it was Tomball Regional, which was owned by somebody else at that time. In any case, that was owned by somebody else, and it was they actually were looking for somebody to take over the lease. So I kind of lucked out that I walked into an office which was built.
That's great. Yeah. So it was already built, right?
It had everything. It had computers. It had an EKG machine. It had,
oh my gosh,
autoclave. So I ended up, I still had to purchase everything. I had to buy everything. But I ended up buying those things at a discounted or a subsidized rate because it wasn't new. So a lot of the things in my office that you see right now, even this desk that I'm sitting at, the painting behind me, I had to pay for each one of these things because legally you're required to buy everything, but it came at a discounted rate. So that's how I got started. And then I had in my income guarantee contract an amount of money allocated for a startup cost. Which was pretty significantly, it helped me purchase some of these things that I needed to at that point in time.
And that's great. So the startup cost. Now, I know there's some contracts out there that not only guarantees your salary, but your employee salaries as well. Is that part of your contract, or is it just your contract?
So the way that my contract was is that the hospital said that, okay, we are going to give you, I forget what the dollar, maybe it was, okay, yeah, I think it was $20,000 per month, okay? So 20,000, or no, so maybe it was 25. So we're going to give you $25,000 per month for a period of 12 months, okay? This is apart from the startup cost. So 25K per month, this includes your rent, your salary, your staff salary, however you want to spend that money, but you have to show how you're spending that money. So that's number one. And number two, so for example, you're guaranteed to get $25,000 from the hospital, and you bring in that month 2,000. So you get 25 minus 2, 23,000. So their hope is that you bring in 2,000 first month, they give you 22. Month two, you bring in 5, they give you 20. Month three, you bring in 15, they give you 10. And by 6 months or 8 months, you're on your own. So they don't give you anything. And now you're kind of locked into this contract where you're going to be serving this area. And it's a win-win situation for the hospital, because with them spending 50,000 on a startup cost and 150K on those 6, 7, 8 months, now they have a primary care physician who is not obligated to send them business or to use their facilities, but you kind of have like a soft corner for, I mean, obviously I'm going to have a relationship within a hospital that helped me out when I was just starting out. So I think that those kinds of, it's a smart move by the hospital setting from the, yes. from the hospital. Yeah.
That's the thing. You're not obligated to send business that way because it's illegal.
It is illegal.
So otherwise, it'd be considered a kickback, and people can't do that.
And they mentioned in the contracts that, hey, this is by
right.
In any way, by doing that, you're required to send us business or anything. But, you know, it's kind of like I scratch your back, you scratch my back, with an undertone. But, you know, I admit, even after that, I admit patients in HCA Tombol, I admit patients when to Methodist. Or in Memorial Hermann. So, you know, I'm not obligated to use any.
Right, right. Yeah, like you said, more of a soft, not really obligation, but it's a relationship building process. At the same time, you are free to do whatever you want, which is not really the same in a larger institution, which you're kind of, you know, they can't make you stay within network, but it's like, we really want you to do this, right?
Exactly.
So I think that the important part is, not only are you de-risking yourself in opening private practice, there's all this found money, there is forgiveness if you stay within that zip code. You also don't have to worry about what most businesses struggle with, which is startup costs and operational cash flow. Mm-hmm. And once you're able to get a lot of the patients in, provide finances and get that in, you don't really have a risk from the financial side of starting the private practice. And that's why this is such an important tool. Now, here's the thing. You didn't go this route, but I did. Banks. Mm-hmm. So banks have a similar strategy, except there's usually no forgiveness from the banking side. And then there's also, aside from banks, not many people know this, there's private equity funds for physician startups as well. It's pretty rare, but because it's such low risk for physician startups to go belly up, that it's a very attractive fund. And a lot of them is actually by other physicians as well, and which you can find. And so, you know, I think that nowadays, and I wish they told us this in residency, right? Nowadays, I wish they told us that, hey, it's actually relatively easy to get. To do a startup. I think the language in training programs is that, hey, because you're not an academic institution, then it's probably not worth it. But that's come from a very biased point of view, because you're working with people within academia who value academia, you know, at the highest level, right? That's okay. If you're not within academia, then you're crap, whatever it is, right? Yeah. But then you know, right now you're in such a good situation because you de-risk yourself for the startup cost. You continue to have that sense of contribution because you have students still, right? Yeah. And then you're building your own equity at this time within your own business, within to yourself, and that fulfills you from the growth side as well. And you still retain significance because you're doing the things that you want to do, and also you're probably making a whole lot more as well, right?
Absolutely. No, that's so true. And you know, the thing is that whichever route you go through, the initial, my experience with the income guarantee was so good that, like you correctly stated, it took one financial burden out of me. It was one less thing that I had to worry about, because I knew that, hey, at the end of the month, if I'm bringing in only $1,000 or $2,000 per month or for that month, I'm guaranteed a salary because the hospital is going to pay me. So it it alleviates a little bit of that stress. But like you said, if banks do the same thing, but you have to pay them back. So the bottom line is that it can be done. And it is, you just have to explore, you have to keep calling, you have to show up. And another thing that people don't realize is that, you know, when I was at UTMB, the CEO of UTMB was a big shot that I never saw, and you could never go and meet the CEO, right? You could never meet the CEO of a big hospital system. But in smaller community hospitals, you can call and say, hey, I'm a primary care doctor and I would like to schedule a meeting with the CEO. And you go and meet with the CEO and they will meet you and they will talk to you and they will say that, hey, we will get back to you. Which, so I had a competing offer from two different hospitals, very similar. And I decided to go with one. And Memorial Hermann was the first one that offered me. And that offer actually helped me get a better offer from HCA. When I said that, hey, I've already have an offer. And they said, no, don't go with Memorial Hermann. We really want you to go with us. And that's how this whole thing came about.
No, that's such a valuable lesson and a great lesson, because we as physicians actually have a huge leg up on this. Because there's, you know, if you're getting money the traditional way, which is basically getting your FICO scores and get all the stuff in order, there's a whole other system out there for private practices that doesn't really exist, but it's not marketed that well or at all, actually. Yeah. No, so I feel like if you're getting Instagram ads, the targeted ads via some algorithm from YouTube or Google or whatever, then you're going to be wanting to go with specific, you know, loan structures. And there's nothing wrong with loan structures, because not all zip codes qualify for what you and I had, right? Right. Actually, my new zip code didn't. So I actually used a loan to start my new facility, because that was not a zip code that required or qualified for these things. So, but let's, you know, these are all the great things. Let's talk about the pain points for a while, because there's actually a lot.
Yep.
But can you go through some of the pain points that you had when you first started, and how were you able to overcome those challenges?
Yep, absolutely. So I think that one of the big challenges when you transition from having an employed position to kind of starting something on your own is to learn man management. I think man management was the biggest surprise for me, to learn how difficult, you know, hiring, firing, keeping a staff, happy. So that was, you know, I actually maybe lost a medical assistant 2 weeks after opening doors because of some issue, and then lost another one. Then so there were a lot of issues initially. So it made me realize that, you know, when you hire people, and I think that we had a conversation about this as well, where you told me how a streamlined process you had, where you interview people through a process, and that really was something that I took to heart and then really used it. You have to hire the right people. You have to keep your employees happy. You have to be a good employer, because you're in the market which is competitive, and you know, people are going to, salaries need to be competitive, benefits need to be competitive. So that was a big learning curve for me, to how to do human resource management. Because that's very, very difficult, and it's a challenge to this day, right? It's in private practice. We all know
it's a challenge.
You don't want it to be a revolving door. You want to build a stable core team that kind of grows with you, but sometimes people move away, people have family issues, different things like that, and you cannot compete with a big like Methodist system or an HCA system, or you know, you're a much smaller company. So we realize that. So that's definitely something that you learn with time, and you talk to mentors and see how they're doing it and what are some of the things that are working for them, so that you try to incorporate some of that into your own practice.
I'm going to echo you on you here. Human resources and people management is the hardest thing to learn at the very beginning, because you're not used to it, because you come from a situation where you are the person being managed, right?
Exactly.
And then when you flip it and then all of a sudden have to develop leadership skills, that's far more robust than academia, right?
Yeah.
Then because if your paycheck to them is their livelihood. And at the same time, you're also spending money and your own resources, taking time away from you and your family and training these people. So if they leave, the turnover is is high, then it becomes an issue. Now, we did talk about this before, how there's got to be a streamlined way of interviewing, and there also has to be a streamlined way of documenting your process. And we actually use a program that we use for all, like, it's like an online training program, and the link is with the description in this video, guys, if you want to know about it. So, and that allows us to pre-train people, and sometimes, and now we pre-qualify people. Say, hey, start this online university pre-application process, and we talk about what our core values of the company are, and basically, it's like we're trying to build a tribe, and that's what I want people to understand in private practice. And I'm sure, you know, by now we both learned that it's all about tribal building and tribal leadership. If you are coming at a point where you're, okay, here's the medical system, front office, back office, and here's the job requirements, and then you hire people into that, most likely you're going to have a relatively high turnover versus if you come to the mindset of building a tribe. So, you know, I'm Cheng Ron, Texas Center for Lifestyle Medicine. Our values are communication with our patients, and utilizing food and lifestyle metrics to improve chronic health. Is this something that you're interested in being a part of, right? So that's different conversations than, hey, do you want to be my MA? You know? And I think for you, you're also an integrative family physician too. So you have a very unique subset over there as well. And I think that language really needs to be spoken about, hey, what are the special, unique things about my practice that I value? And I want the same things for my employees to value as well. Now, if they don't value it or they devalue it, and you can tell during the interview or the interview questions, they may not be the best fit, because that matters way more than the resume. Because we can train people to do anything, you know, but you can't train attitude and culture without spending an exorbitant amount of energy to do so, right? And it is about building that tribe, man, you know?
And you have to build that team setting. You have to, there was a saying that, you know, take care of your employees, and your employees are going to take care of your business. So you have to have that mentality, that mindset, that and like one thing that I've told my staff, like, for me, customer service is very important, right? So I pride myself in, hey, I'm available for my patients. If you call, you are seen today, if not today, tomorrow. And I expect my team to echo the sentiment that, hey, we're a place where you come in and you deserve or get a level of service that you typically don't get at other primary care offices, or that kind of sets us apart. So that is good for business growth. It brings in new patients. For example, you know, I pay a lot of emphasis on online ratings and online reviews. And
yeah, you kill it online reviews, man. I think you have 500 5-star reviews or something like that. That's crazy.
So that is something that, you know, all my staff knows that, hey, if there is a person who writes a 1-star Google rating, and it has to do with something other than myself, then there's going to be some explanation that's going to be called as to why that happened. And albeit you cannot keep everybody happy, but it's something that I realized very early on that, you know, for my patient population, which is a younger patient population, that every day I hear, I kid you not, that how did you hear about us? Online reviews. So, you know, it's something that drives in business. And if it's something that drives in business for the work that we're doing, so we want to continue doing that work, and we want a team that recognizes it and can build on those same principles. Something happened where
I was showing people that you have 471 Google reviews. Mm-hmm. and you average on a 5-star. I mean, that is so rare. I mean, it's almost it's almost, you know, not existing within medical practices. So good job for that, man. I mean, this is just in a couple years, bro. I mean, people are trying to get to this level for multiple different things. But I think that, you know, that's the point about building the team. Because if you think about it, a lot of people have a lot of gripes on social media and stuff like that, because it's usually the front desk or the back office, or you know, delays and refills and yada yada yada. So I think that building that team that supports that customer service setting is crucial. So yep. I just did a on another part of the segment with Haley Fisher Wright. Dr. Fisher Wright is the CEO of MGMA, Medical Group Management Association. And her and I agree on one thing, is that the mentality of a patient is that in addition to a patient, they're also clients. And even though some people cringe at the aspect, we have to treat them that way, because that's the mentality of over delivery. And that's how you decrease burnout, actually. Yeah. People think, yeah, it's the opposite, but that's true, right?
And you know, there's value in trying to get to that early on, and understanding that it's very important in private practice that you know that, hey, this is, at the end of the day, you have to run a smooth business operation, right? It's one thing being a very caring physician. If you're a very caring physician, if you're good at what you do, your business will grow. But unless you understand the dynamics of money in, money out, expenses, overheads, then it's not going to work. So it's very important that, hey, these are, at the end of the day, they are clients that you need to keep satisfied. It's a happy client, because they're going to send their families, or they're going to tell 10 people that, hey, never go there.
Right. And I think a lot of doctors also kind of fearing that with over delivery of this value, it kind of burns them out. But honestly, if you look at the studies, the opposite is true. Is that if you provide that sort of environment for your practice, for your patients, and then your staff reflects it, I mean, that's how you get, you know, that you know, 500 five-star reviews over 3.5 years. And but not only about the reviews, is that we have to think about, here's the thing that no one thinks about. What I just showed on the screen, which is basically your practice having, you know, all those Google reviews, your great, 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 great grandchildren are going to see that. You're developing your legacy. And those people have to understand that whenever you have a digital footprint that's on Google, by the way, Google actually owns the internet. When you have a digital footprint that's on Google, this is there forever. And this is going to be the legacy that you have, because you're going to be someone's ancestor later on. And this is actually indexed, and they look back and it's like, wow, you know, you had all these great reviews.
Yeah.
And, you know, grandpa was such a great doctor and people loved him. And that's the thing. And this is called building digital equity. It's not a concept people understand, because we don't experience in that, because this is relatively new for us, but man, like, everything's indexed right now. And then now cryptocurrency is seen as hard currency, right? And so we have to live in the digital age and understand that if you are one of those doctors right now and you have not so great reviews, I actually have an online course. It's free. It's actually with the description in this video about how to get constant five-star reviews and raving patient fans. And so just go ahead and check that out. It's a very simple 30-minute mini course you go through. But that's the thing. You got to build a team. And the biggest pain point is always in human resources and understanding that. But it's so worth it when you are in a hurry to fail. You hire some people. Okay, this didn't work out. But it's so worth it to understand that you get what you tolerate, which means that if you have someone that's not doing what they're supposed to do, they're not meeting expectations and outcomes, if you don't let them go, you get what you tolerate. And I think a lot of practices do this, and it's really unnecessary. That's a big problem.
What is a good fit with you and what is not, right? And one thing that I'm going to add to this whole reputation management, or just starting off your own business, is that you have to know what will work for you. So for example, when I started out, my mentor, who is I told you about earlier, there's a service called ZocDoc, and a lot of people might be aware of it. It's an online scheduling and thing. So I signed up for ZocDoc initially when I first opened up, and it was about $300 per month. That was a large amount of money at that time for me to spend on a subscription service, but it gave me a lot of patience, and it was a good investment for me to make at that time, which my mentor did not seem to think that it was worth it, because she already had a lot of patients. She opened in League City, that a lot of patients followed up with her. So you will know what works for you, and you have to just kind of follow through with it. Get advice from a few different people, process that, digest that, and then act on what you think is going to be good for your practice.
What a great talk we're having right now, because I think that, you know, these are general principles to kind of go on with private practice, even non-private, even if you're academia. What everyone should do right now is go into Google and then Google your name in Google Maps, not in regular Google, in Google Maps. And if you don't have a location for your Google Maps, create a Google business profile with your actual name. And then you can actually send that to either patients or whoever it is that you take care of, even if you're outside of a private practice institution, because you are. So what you want to do is you can actually build your 5 stars before you even go into private practice.
Right. 100%.
I actually did that in New York. So yeah. I transferred my stars in New York, and I was like, hey, I changed location to Houston, Texas. And yeah. I actually carried a lot of that stuff with me. And right now, the new thing with Google, especially with Google Business, you can even create your own business website. It's completely free. It's called Google Business. You can sign up. It's completely free. You have your own thing. And then you can make sort of your personal like website and account, right? And it's totally cool because it's just you. And then that's how you sort of build that brand equity of being your own brand, right? And so, and I think that's just it's a great accomplishment. Once again, you know, you have more 5 stars than our facility, which is awesome because we actually have a bunch too, you know. Here's another pain point I want you to talk about is, yes, we talked about, you know, employees and building a culture, building a tribe, leadership. Let's talk about this. Let's talk about the revenue cycle for a second. So how we get paid. Mm-hmm. I had no idea how freaking complex it was to get paid and how extraordinarily unnecessarily complex is to get paid till I went into private practice. You feel the same way?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So I think that one of the things that was very important to realize very quickly was that, you know, you have to learn the revenue cycle very, very quickly, how important your CPT codes are, how important your billing is, and then to have a good billings person, either dedicated that is dedicatedly looking at that, or somebody who can follow up on claims and denials and basically work with you to see what are some of the things that where you're missing out on revenue. So I realized that pretty quickly, and it was a painful process. I remember one thing that you told me initially when this is one of our first conversations is, hey, a money not spent is a money, a dollar not spent is a dollar saved, right?
Yeah.
So, right. And so important to realize that, because there'll be so many expenses, and you have to make sure that your revenue is in a way that can offset those expenses. Keep your overhead low, and make sure that you're exploring all the avenues that bring in more revenue. And it's important to understand that concept, because every other specialty, be it cardiology, GI doctors, plastic surgeons, everybody's. And that's how private practice thrives, is to figure out pockets of where that revenue cycle is, and to tap into those.
Yeah, totally right. I mean, this is a huge lesson too, because both of us went through a lot of those pain points, and a lot of doctors as well. I think most practices do, and even larger institutions go through the exact same pain points on revenue cycle collections. Because here's the thing, you know, the insurance's job is to make sure that it's relatively hard for us to get paid And if they can delay that, if they could delay the reimbursement, the chances are a lot of the newer doctors don't go after it. So there's three whistleblowers within three different insurance networks in the last decade that talks about automatic claim denials. So this is big. So what happens is, I'm not gonna name insurers, is that the if you can think of the three largest insurance networks right now off the top of your head, it's them. So one whistleblower was talking about if you are a private practice under the age of 3 years old, you have 25% of your claims denied automatically. Why? Because the chances are you going after them is very minimal when you first start off because you know nothing. Okay. And between 5 and 7 years old in private practice, then it's not 1 in 4, it's about 1 in 6 or so. And if there's any new code, if you've been in private practice and there's any new codes that pop up that is not billed before, basically adding a service line of 50% of it is requiring a lot more documentation and seeing that because it delays your revenue cycle. So insurance companies make money by it's not just not paying you, but it's not paying you, but if they do pay you, they delay the payment. Yeah, so money is calculated not just an amount, but amount over time. And we call that cash flow. So a lot of private practice doctors are praised to this. And the insurance companies see that, oh my gosh, this guy's been like just writing off claims for the last 6 years. We're gonna continue to do 1 in 4 denials. They have artificial intelligence robots that risk stratify practices with this behavior. So if your revenue cycle, if you think you're gonna be one submitting everything and not going after your claims just for the first few years, know that over a few years, that's over $1 million you're probably gonna lose because of the habits of your actual billing. That pissed me off so much because of the fact that why is it so hard for private practices to start and be sustainable is because of actions like these as well. So people are a lot of startups are like, okay, we're going to get this billing company to do our billing service, or I'm gonna hire my own billers. But it's not something that you should take lightly, and because you have to understand that your billing cycle or revenue has to have a very consistent, I'm gonna go at it, go at it, go at it, especially if you're starting out. So that's really
Not
important.
agree with you more. They said that a good billing cycle or a billing revenue
Revenue
generation
cycle, yeah.
is going to be the backbone, or it's going to make or break your practice. So this could be not be further from, I mean, closer to the truth that it's very, very important. And these are things that you learn on later on. I mean, I've gone through. We've kind of talked about this ourselves. I started out as having an in-house biller. Did not work well, then moved on to somebody else. Did not, you continuously learn, and it's a continuously evolving process. If you think that you're happy and set, and somebody's been working great for like 15 years, then kudos to you. And I would suggest that you need to kind of take a deeper look at your accounts receivable, and what is because one of the challenges is, Shang, is that we get so busy. We get so busy. Hey, I have to see the patients, I have to do refills, I have to return phone calls, I have to get home to my family, that I'm not can't be bothered to, now when I can go home, now I need to sit down and talk, look at ARs and what is happening. So I think that a lot of times billing companies take advantage of that, of the little guy that, hey, he's just so busy trying to make ends meet and trying to get the revenue generated that they're not probably going to be bothered about what are the claims that are denied, why were they denied. That's the service that you provided. That it's the same thing as having going to a restaurant, eating a steak, walking away, and not paying the bill.
Absolutely. Yeah, and believe it or not, now, especially ever since coronavirus, there are so many Silicon Valley companies that actually have robots to fight the insurance company robots. And so what happens is a risk stratify your claims for denial and gives you a pattern of coding to or sorry of submissions and resubmissions to utilize. So it literally combats the enemy, like a robot versus robot war. That's where we're at right now. Yep. If you guys are interested in that, is a company I work with, and the link is with the description below with this video. If you click on that, if you actually are in private practice, they give you an entire lowdown of what you're leaving on the table. The robot actually does a really good job. It's a combination of robots and humans. And so, you know, yeah, these are the lessons, man. These are, if people understand these main lessons, like, you should be pretty good to go. So once again, as a recap, find money where you can. Talk to the major hospital systems if you're wanting to move into an area, if you haven't started up yet, or if you did start up and you're already in the way. Find, this is something we didn't really touch a whole lot, but actually find more money than you need. So there's this book by Tillman Fertitta, which talks about, well, the book is called Shut Up and Listen. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I thought the book was about shut up and listen to Tillman, but it's really about shut up and listen to your clients, right? And in this book, he talks about listening to the clients, which are basically our patients. What do they really want? But another big lesson that I suffered this pain point in the very beginning is that I only got enough for what I think was needed to run a practice. And then 6 weeks later, we had Hurricane Harvey, where half the city or 3/4 of the city was flooded, right? And so I didn't plan for catastrophes. And so that book actually taught me a valuable lesson is, yeah, you have to have operating cash flow and reserves. So get more than you need. And then as you go along, keep that 1 year of operating cash flow there, and then pay back the loan as you go, because that's going to have a dramatic improvement in longevity on whatever natural disaster comes your way, whether it's Hurricane Harvey or coronavirus, right? And so get more than what you need. And right now, honestly, if some physicians don't even have good credit, there's companies out there that also have a career-based loan risk assessment if you're a physician. Even if you're coming out of fellowship or residency, they risk stratify you based on your career trajectory, and you can actually get loans from that too. So there's all sorts of things out right now. It's just that it's not marketed very well, I think, to physicians, and it's relatively new. But right now, we have to use every tool that we can. The other industries have already used in startup businesses to leverage that on our own. But that's the whole reason why I created this summit. Absolutely. So, you know, but we grew a lot over the last few years, and we'll continue to grow. And we're always under a constant, never ending cycle of improvement. And that's always going to be true. And that leads to our growth. And we really have to really support each other as physicians and give each other resources. And that's really the era of collaboration that we should really have, you know?
Yep. No, I think that this is a great initiative by you and your team to kind of put this thing together. I wish that if I was starting back, taking back 3 years, if there was some resource like this. So for somebody who's, you know, on the fence or thinking of throwing their hat into the ring or, you know, making the move, you know, like I said, find people that you can talk to, that you can find that can be your mentors, and then those will be absolute valuable resources. And look into, you know, avenues like these where you can learn from other people and learn from other people's experiences. A lot of the things that we talked about are going to work for a lot of people. Some things might not. So you just have to kind of find your own path and your own journey. But the principles remain the same, that it can be done. There is a method to the madness. It's a lot of hard work. So is anything else in life that is worth anything worth doing is worth doing well, right? So it absolutely can be done. You just have to learn. And we continue to grow, continue to learn, have an open mind. And there is no reason why you cannot be successful doing it.
Yeah. And be unique and be true to yourself, too. I think that's the other thing, you know. I was talking to both of our friends, Dr. Radha Tamarisa, integrative gastroenterologist, on another segment of this. And we were just really talking about, like, being authentic to ourselves and our uniqueness and having a lot of that creativity come out, right? And so, you know, you have your niche, which is you have family practice and integrative health. And oh, you also have an IV infusion center, just like I do. So that's very unique to primary care practice. So there's a lot of things that can be curated and generated as long as the foundations are set, right? And that's the lesson here. Things are possible, you know?
100%.
Yeah. So thanks a lot for coming on with me, man. It's been such a wonderful time chatting with you and reconnecting again. I hope that doctors see this and get really inspired and take that step, should they choose to. And some people will hear about this and say, "Nah, you know what? It's too complex for me." And that's fine. At least we laid it out to know what you expect. Because the whole point of this is to do in what's in your power for yourself to make yourself and your family happy, and to put that value and growth and contribution within your heart. And that's the most important thing for doctors, you know?
No, 100%. I like I said, it's been a pleasure talking to you. I know we keep bouncing ideas from each other, and that's what we need. We need to inspire and other people to who have that hunger to do something on their own, that it can be done, and use absolutely all resources available at their disposal to make it happen.
Absolutely. Well, great talking to you. And people, take some action, and be absolute critical that you just want to be authentic for yourself. So I thank you for coming on. We're signing off.
All right.